George W. Johnson. Yes, the fellow that is famous for the Laughing Song recording, later covered by a host of other recording artists for many decades after. So I give you Tim Brooks.
I apologize for having the title slides sitting up there looking at you for so long, but even though it worked in practice, I'm very nervous about anything that works the first time, just like a famous inventor, you might recall. So I just sort of left it up there. George W. Johnson, is an interesting person to me, was an interesting person to me to work on because he's little recognized in the later literature, either of African-American culture or in recording or music for that matter. And yet he was a genuine first. He was I put star in quotes, but he was really a star in the recording industry in its earliest days of some dimensions. And as such was influential to things that came later, which I will get into. And so digging into his story, starting about 15 years ago, was something that I was really curious about. And what I found surprised me, and I hope some of it may be new to you as well. He was the first African-American recording artist to make commercial records, period. May have been the first African-American to make any recordings, actually, since there's indications that he made tinfoil cylinders back in the, right after the invention of the phonograph. Until now, we haven't known a lot about him. Here's a timeline of, basically, since his death. He died in 1914 in New York, in obscurity by that time. His records were all out of print by the year after that. Pretty much forgotten even then. 25 years later, 1942, he was mentioned in a reminiscence book by Fred Gaisberg, the pioneer producer extraordinaire of the early recording industry, who basically told some stories about him, anecdotal stories about him that have lived on, including the story that he was this is almost in quotes, the tragic Negro who was hanged for throwing his wife out a window while in a drunken frenzy. That's such a good story that later writers simply have not been able to restrain themselves in repeating it. 2 years after that, Jim Walsh, the pioneer, one of the first researchers actually on the early history of the phonograph, who did his work when many of the pioneers were still alive, lucky him, wrote an article about George W. Johnson. He couldn't find out very much at that time. It was a pretty short article, but it did put some things into print about him, at least, for the first time. Almost 30 years after that, in 1971, Walsh had found some more information, including a reminiscence that Johnson was not, in fact, hanged, and he wrote a second series of articles. He filled in more, but he was still missing a lot of the pieces, and unfortunately, in speculating on what might have happened, he introduced some new inaccurate information into the stream. And that began to take root. And during the 1980s, there were a number of references to Johnson on liner notes and other places, some repeating the old story about having been hanged, some other things about his career. I wrote an article or a series of articles starting in 1989 about old canards of the industry that seemingly would never go away, called Lies That Will Not Die, and Johnson was one of those in those stories. But it's one thing to criticize what other people do, it's another thing to do to fix it yourself. I dug into see what I could find out about George W. Johnson. That led to about 13 years of research, if I'd known what I was getting into, quotes, which covered not only Johnson ultimately, but all those other artists that are in the book that Les mentioned. So this is what I've been able to find of the story of what, in fact, the career and life of George W. Johnson was like. He was born, in fact, in 1846. In Loudoun County, Virginia, which is in the northeast corner of Virginia, up near West Virginia, near the town of Leesburg, a very historic place, which is still there. This is Leesburg at about that time, as a matter of fact. He was born a slave, as was later reported in various places. His parents, his father was 15 at the time, his mother was a girl of 13 years old. two slaves. He was placed as a baby with a family called the Moores, a farming family, but a prosperous one with a large family on their farm, Glenmore, which was near Leesburg. He was made what was called at the time the body servant of their young son who had just been born, Samuel. Body servant was, in fact, a playmate among kids. They hadn't learned yet about slavery. And Johnson, in fact, grew up in this household, this white, prosperous household, as the playmate of their youngest child, Samuel. They treated him, apparently, pretty well. They, among other things, taught him or allowed him to learn how to read and write, which was technically illegal to teach slaves to do that in antebellum Virginia. He had his first exposure to music. Their children had music lessons. Samuel had flute lessons, and Johnson was allowed to sit in on those and had his first formal exposure to music at some level. He had a very engaging, friendly disposition by all accounts later in his life. And I think it can't be underestimated how this being raised by this white family in pre-Civil War Virginia in this manner helped him become accustomed to whites and living with white families and they to getting along with him as well. That was something that many blacks did not experience, most blacks did not experience in that era. The Civil War broke out in 1861. Loudoun County was, in some ways, one of the epicenters of the Civil War. I was a little surprised as I dug into it. Those from the area might not be. But some of the major battles, Gettysburg was just to the north of there, Harper's Ferry across the river, of course. And Loudoun County, there were many battles in that area. It was a Confederate state, of course, although the county itself was split initially. A lot of Quakers in Loudoun County. Nevertheless, they sided with the Confederacy, and some of the Moore family went and joined the Confederate Army. It was also the prime operating territory for Colonel John Mosby, who some of you may know as the Gray Ghost of Civil War fame, who staged guerrilla attacks on the Union troops all across Loudoun County, very effective attacks. Finally, General Grant sent a Union division into Loudoun County and basically destroyed the county in order to rid the Union of Mosby. They burned the farms, they burned the crops, they leveled the county. And by the time the war ended in 1865, Loudoun County was devastated economically. That meant for the then teenaged Johnson, who by then had left the Moore household. The Moores themselves were hard hit, of course, and lost most of their wealth. That there was very little work and very little for him to do in Loudoun County. He worked as a menial work on farms in the area for a while. The family, such as it had been, that he had had, was dispersed by then. We don't even know what happened to them. And this is his timeline from that point. He moved to New York in the mid-1870s. Took up residence in the Hell's Kitchen area, the tenements where blacks and poor Irish and others lived. Made his living as a street entertainer, whistling for pennies and nickels on the street. There is evidence, as I say, that around 1878, 1879, he made tinfoil recordings. They were exhibiting the newly invented tinfoil phonograph at that time. And as a whistler, that makes a lot of sense. But basically, throughout the 1880s, he was a street entertainer, and by most reports, something of a character in New York. Increasingly well known in the ferry terminals, he was one of the street entertainers who was known around the city. In the late 1880s, the phonograph was improved. I won't go into all the details here. Some of you are experts on this, but both Edison and his competitors brought out wax cylinder machines that could record on more permanent, not totally permanent, but more permanent wax cylinders. And they began to be sold to exhibitors who took them around the country, set up arcades and so forth. And these exhibitors needed something to play for the customers, some sort of entertainment records. So bands started to be recorded, elocutionists, that sort of thing. And in the spring of 1890, and we can date this pretty precisely, actually, thanks to financial books that still survive at the Edison National Historic Site for company, not Edison, but for companies that Edison absorbed, one of which was the Metropolitan Phonograph Company. We can trace that as early as May of 1890, they were selling George W. Johnson's two specialty numbers by him, most likely. And they were paying him to make more shortly thereafter. So by the spring of 1890, just when this industry, which we now know as the recording industry, was just beginning to feed these exhibitors, Johnson was called in to make some records, make some cylinders. He recorded both for the Metropolitan Phonograph Company, which operated in Manhattan, and a few months later, starting for the New Jersey Phonograph Company across the river in Newark. Both of them marketed his cylinders to these exhibitors. I get lost here. This is a picture of Johnson, the first one we have from 1892, actually, so about this period. He's already in his mid-40s at this time. He's not a young man. He's still making his living busking on the streets, so to speak. However, he's now got this extra gig. Both of these phonograph companies want to bring him in to make some cylinders. And to probably the surprise of everybody, not excluding Johnson himself, these two cylinders that he makes, these first two songs that he records, become immediately successful on the exhibition machines. They are the first cylinders ever made, as far as I can trace, by any African American for commercial sale. They're both humorous specialties, and they're both very, very popular right from the start. One of them is called The Whistling Coon. That's a vaudeville song that was written by Sam DeVere, a white vaudeville performer who'd been in the business for 20 years at that point, who sang it himself in vaudeville quite a bit, never recorded it. And that showed off Johnson's whistling abilities. Excuse me. And the other one is called The Laughing Song. We don't know who the author of that is. Johnson himself copyrighted it years later, but likely it was written by somebody for him or with him or something. And the purpose of The Laughing Song was to show off his hearty laughter, which was part of his act, as he laughed in time with the music. Now, I'll play you a little bit of The Laughing Song. The thing to notice in this, as you hear it, if you know anything about, and I'm sorry I can't play you comparative examples due to time, to other recordings that were made at that time, is most of them, to our ears, are fairly stilted. They're singing very much directly from the music. They're enunciating extremely carefully and loudly to make themselves heard through the primitive recording apparatus of that time. Johnson, when he sang, he slurred his vowels and words. He interjected laughs, a very loose kind of performance, which is very much unlike the stagey performance of that you typically heard at that time or at any time in the early days of the recording industry. It sounds, in other words, a lot like he would have sounded, presumably, on the streets. And that's probably part of what it made it such a novel recording for the time. This is a little bit, if I can get my technology behind me to work. The cylinders work. I can't vouch for the CD player.
The Laughing Song by George W. Johnson, Columbia Records. As I was coming around the corner, I heard some people say, "Here comes an Andy Doc, here he comes this way. With a heeler like a snowplow, his mouth is like a trap, and when he opens it gently, you will see a fearful gap." And then I laughed. I got Danny Hill from the heavy. I got Danny Hill from the heavy. They said his mother was a princess, his father was a prince, and he's been the apple of their eye, yet not gonna quit. But he'll be the king of Asgard, sweet by and by. That's what I heard him say, if I laugh until I cried, then I laughed.
And now, courtesy of Glenn Sage, who did some transfers for me, notice how he sang about Africa. Here's four different recordings of this song by him And just that phrase, how does he treat the word Africa, for example, or Africa?
But he'll be the king of Africa, bye-bye. But he'll be the king of Africa, bye-bye. But he'll be the king of Africa, bye-bye. But he'll be the king of Africa, bye-bye.
That last one is the kind of stuff we audio archaeologists have to put up with. hard to get good copies of these things. Even in between recordings, he slurred and changed things a little bit. But it was a very distinctive style of performing for that time. And that undoubtedly is part of what made these records such novelties and so popular. Well, he recorded the two songs primarily for exhibitors, as I said. Here's a picture of one of those traveling exhibitors in the early 1890s. Fascinating picture, actually. The proprietor looking very dapper and distinguished in the front, so that even ladies would be willing to approach this person. He's got his cylinder machine inside a glass case there. You see the ear tubes hanging down around the side of it. You paid your nickel or your penny or whatever it was, put the ear tubes to your ear, and wonder of wonders, the marine band started coming out of this machine, or George W. Johnson. He's got his two assistants, who don't have to look so dapper, sitting behind him there. Has put a little canopy over it. There were reports in the trade papers of this time from exhibitors like this one, and perhaps this one, actually, describing how they get so much business, they have to work 6 days a week, and they just won't work on the seventh because they got to rest sometime. They're getting a lot of traffic, including very proper people, ladies as well as men. They don't put any songs on their machines that would offend. Obviously, they didn't consider this to be such a recording. And that Johnson's recordings were among their most popular. That recurs, that statement. So there seems to be a good deal of evidence that, in fact, these recordings were not only popular, they were very popular. There was no way to duplicate them. No effective duplicating when Johnson started in 1890, and it only slowly began to take hold during the rest of the decade. So Johnson was called back over and over again to make more copies because these exhibitors wore them out. As the years passed, there were some figures published. In 1894, an item cited 25,000 copies of these cylinders having been sold by that time. And if you think how they were made, that's a lot of time singing those songs. In 1895, it was up to 30,000. Shortly after that, 38,000. And finally, in the late 90s, the figure 50,000 was published. Whatever the figure, and there are some comparative figures for others around that time, which are more modest than that. These were bestsellers. They also got Johnson some other work. During the 1890-91 season, he had a bit part in a play called The Inspector, doing his specialty in New York. And he was called to whistle for the rich people in their mansions, as a report of him whistling for Mrs. Vanderbilt. Mrs. Vanderbilt would not go to the variety theaters, thank you. But she would have the very best of the performers brought to her parlor to perform for her. And Johnson was one of those. He was the only prominent black man recording at that time. And his cylinders, not only in 1890, but in 91, 92, 93, they just get more popular. In 1894, he met a young man by the name of Len Spencer, who was quite a character and a real operator in the early phonograph business. He was a performer, a writer, a producer, and he came up with the idea for his record company, one of his record companies, New Jersey, to put out a series of minstrel cylinders. And his idea was, everybody was going to minstrel shows, you'd do a little 2-3 minute vignette, whatever would fit on a cylinder, recreating the experience of a minstrel show. It would start with the overture, the traditional gentlemen be seated, a couple of jokes between Tambo and Bones, the end men, accompanied by cheers and so forth, a song by the star tenor, and then the finale, or a musical punctuation of some sort. Very unusual, again, for the time. Spencer assembled a little recording team, which he called the Imperial Minstrels, consisting of himself and Billy Williams of Vaudevillian as the end men, Dan W. Quinn as the star tenor, and he recruited George W. Johnson to do his laughter and also his laughing song on one of those cylinders. The Cylinders came out in early 1894. They too were bestsellers. It was a very novel idea. Everybody started imitating them, but the Imperial Minstrels for years were the leading purveyors of this kind of thing, and George Johnson was, you might say, Len Spencer's main man as far as his jeering section and, his, of course, his laughing song goes. Here's a part of one of those minstrel cylinders, and I'll show you along with it the sheet music that was ultimately published with that quote of 50,000 copies for the laughing song with another later picture of Johnson.
Minstrel record the great laughing song. Gentlemen, be seated. Introductory overture. I say, Mr. Henry, money's mighty cheap nowadays. Money, Pete Leonard? Why, I failed to get any of it. Why, you can get silver dollars for 45 and 55 cents. Oh, no, sir. I don't believe that. Why, everybody knows that 45 cents and 55 cents makes 100 cents. And you can get a dollar anywhere for that. George W. Johnson in his great laughing song.
Mercifully, I will spare you from the rest of that record and the other jokes, but you get the idea. And Johnson was a principal player in all of Spencer's early minstrel recordings. He was a free agent in the late 1890s, not only for those first two companies that I talked about, Metropolitan gone out of business by that time, but for Columbia, for Berliner, for Edison, and a lot of minor companies. They all wanted his versions of these two songs because they were selling so well for everybody on cylinder and later on disc as well. He did get the opportunity to record a few other titles. He's often thought of as a two-song man, but in fact, in the early 1890s, he recorded something called The Laughing Darkey and Uncle Ned's Dream, neither of which have ever turned up that I know of. In 1896, he recorded Listen to the Mockingbird for Berliner. And in 1897, two new songs that became part of his permanent repertoire, another laughing song, The Laughing Coon, and another whistling song, The Whistling Girl. This is an excerpt from his great whistling specialty, which I haven't played for you yet, along with a picture, a very unusual picture, which the Library of Congress did a blow-up for me of a thumbnail print, a very tiny print, in the Phonoscope, the trade paper of that day. The article talks about Johnson. It does not specifically identify him as being the person in this picture, but it looks like him. And you can see that he's recording in front of three horns there, so at best they could get three copies out of this particular take, if all three were good, which
there are four horns.
Is there a fourth one?
Yeah.
There's the guy's head down. Well, there could be another one.
There are two underneath, and then there's two on top.
Yeah, okay, four. I stand corrected. Four horns. You see the assistant leaning down there, operating the machines, the piano player up on a riser behind him to get the soundboard right behind the horns, and a man who generally fits the description of Johnson in front of the horns. If it is, this would be certainly the only picture of him ever in a recording studio. And this is his whistling special.
I never heard him talk to anybody in my life, but he's happy when he whistled this tune. In the morning, to the day, into the night, and then he whistled like the devil go to bed. Why do whistle like a locomotive engine in his sleep, and whistle when his wife was dead? One day a fella hit him with a brick upon the mouth, he sure to like a balloon. Now he goes along shaking like a monkey in a fit, and this way he whistles that too. Mm-hmm.
short. So the piano player vamps. I don't know if he ever did it three times at the end. That's the first time I've heard twice run through it. But they gave the people their money's worth. Well, that's the whistling specialty. Johnson's personal life in the 90s, something that no one had found before, it turns out to be rather interesting too. It was tumultuous, to say the least. He lived with light-skinned or even white women, apparently, which was something in the 1880s and 1890s for a black, poor black man in Hell's Kitchen was certainly not approved of. In 1893 and 1894, he was living with a German woman who we don't have the name of, who was found dead in her bed. In 1896, he moved in with a mulatto by the name of Roskin Stewart. She was much younger than he. She was in her mid-30s. He was 50 at that time. And by all later accounts, he was kind of a father figure to her. She was a real hellraiser and a heavy drinker, by the neighbors' reports, and he was always trying to calm her down, get her sober. He wasn't too successful at it. She shot him at one point in the ankle. And in 1898, she fell out of a window on West 41st Street. That's apparently the origin of threw her out the window story. She was injured, but not killed. She did not press charges on him. Instead, according to the later reports, she said she'd get hunk with him. I love that phrase. I'm not sure I know what it means, but I think you get it. Nevertheless, they moved in together again. In October of 1899, he came home, according to the testimony, and found her beaten and bleeding after a night of carousing, got her to the hospital where she died. He was arrested for murder. The reason was that the night before, the neighbors had heard them arguing, as they frequently did, and one of the neighbors said he heard Johnson threaten to kill the woman. A previous wife had died mysteriously. The police came after Johnson. He was taken to prison. Inquest was held. And then an amazing thing started to happen. While he was awaiting trial, his white friends started to rally around him. Len Spencer, his friend from minstrel recordings, held a meeting of the artists, the white artists. They raised a fund of $2,000 for his defense, which was quite a considerable amount of money in that time. Two white lawyers, one of them a very prominent criminal attorney, were hired. And character witnesses started to show up to testify on his behalf, including Sam Moore, the son of the slave owner from West Virginia, with whom he had grown up. Moore, by this time, was a successful businessman in Harper's Ferry, or in Leesburg, rather. And he traveled, when he heard about this, just to talk on behalf of the black man he had grown up with. The trial opened on December 20th. There was a huge turnout of blacks and whites and reporters from the local papers, including the tabloids, which are not indexed, thank you, in the New York Times index. The prosecution, of course, in a trial goes first. It was a shambles. I found the transcript, very interesting reading. There were no witnesses to the actual crime against her. No definite cause of death could be established. And the prosecution witnesses who were called, there were about six or eight of them, all spoke very highly of Johnson and said that she was a violent drunk. Not a good prosecution at the beginning. The defense was raised, which was a first-rate defense, was raising objections constantly, asking for dismissal of the case on basis of insufficient evidence. The judge finally said, well, can't we at least hear Johnson's side of this? And as a historian, oh, I wish they had let him do that. But the defense, quite properly, said there's no case here. And the DA finally, when turned to, said, they're right, I don't have a case. The DA drops the case, at which point the case, by law, had to be dismissed. Johnson came out of the courthouse surrounded by a huge crowd of whites and blacks, as the papers like to point out, cheering him, and the whites took him off to dinner, which was a great honor, I suppose, at that time. Which leaves the question of why the case was ever brought in the first place, and It's hard to tell, but based on the testimony, the inquest testimony, and the other things, I suspect it's due to racism in the ranks and file of the New York City Police Department, which was well documented at that time. And if you think about a man making more money than they were, living with white or light-skinned people, even if he wasn't aggressive about it, the beat cops didn't like that much. There was a terrible race riot in New York just the following year, in 1900, which the police egged on, if anything. Not the people in charge, but certainly the rank and file. And this may well have played a part in Johnson's indictment. In any event, it didn't harm his career because obviously he had a lot of friends on both sides of the racial divide. And he resumed his career without difficulty. He recorded for the new Columbia Invictor discs, as well as the new Edison cylinders. And in fact, those recordings made around 1900 are his most frequently found recordings today. He also got to record a few oddities at this time, including the record that I've been looking for years, Carving the Duck, which was in the Zonophone catalog for 4 years, has never turned up to my knowledge. Don't even know what it is for sure, along with his familiar laughing and whistling specialties. And a couple of years later, a routine with his old friend Len Spencer called The Merry Mailman for Columbia. This was a sketch in which Spencer goes from door to door delivering mail to various eccentric characters and doing comedy bits with them. And at the end of the record, he reaches the door of George W. Johnson.
Hello, here's a registered letter for George W. Johnson. I wonder if he's in. I'll knock.
Stop and knock.
Here's your mail.
Stop and knock.
Here's the letter.
Oh, you better stop and knocking at my door.
Let me in.
Stop and knock.
Money boy.
Stop and knock.
All right.
Oh, you better stop and knocking at my door.
Better come down. This letter's pretty heavy. Had some money left you?
Yes, it left me long ago, and I've been short ever since.
Ha ha, but this is a money order.
I didn't order any money, but if it's for Johnson, give it to me.
Well, by that time, 1906, Johnson's professional world was really falling apart. You have to have a label picture if you give a presentation at ours, so here's a label picture. He was known, if a somewhat beat up one, he was known well in the business, and in fact he was referred to by name in a very popular sketch called A Negro Wedding in Southern Georgia, which was a lampoon of a southern rural wedding with all sorts of bits and dialect. And when the groom is finally introduced, he's introduced and the groom, George Washington Johnson, or variations on that name. He did not himself participate, but this record was recorded by many, it's one of the earliest versions, by many white quartets on various labels. So they're certainly referring to him. Johnson himself, by that time, passing into his 50s, reaching 60, the record companies by that time only needed a single original master, and then they could multiply copies and make thousands from that master. They'd learned how to mold cylinders in mass quantities and increase the number of discs that could be pressed from a few hundred to thousands from a single master. And there were no royalties, so unlike other artists who just sang different songs, Johnson was not needed to come back and keep recording those two songs or four songs of his. Other songs artists started to take over his material too. Billy Murray, Cal Stewart, S.H. Dudley all started to record his specialties more successfully in competition with him. And overseas, Bert Shepherd's was the versions that everybody knew from England. So he was out of work. His last recordings were around 1910. He did two cylinders for the U.S. Everlasting Company that you heard about yesterday, and for one last recording for Columbia. Of his famous laughing song. And you notice his name does not even appear on the label anymore. They just call it an old standard. For a while, this is the last known picture of him. For a while, his old friend Len Spencer took care of him. He hired him to be a doorman at his offices. Spencer had a very prosperous booking agency. But Johnson was constantly drunk and borrowing money from the clients and not paying it back. He was genial, but he was a drag on business. And finally, Spencer had to fire him, reluctantly, I think. Johnson moved to Harlem to a small one-room apartment where he died on January 23rd, 1914, at the age of 67, an advanced age for anybody at that time, and certainly for a black man of his background. He was buried in a pauper's grave in Queens, which with great difficulty, I'll tell you about someday, I finally found. And I could find only one obituary for him buried in the black newspaper, the New York Age. His records were soon out of print as well by 1915. Old-timers did remember him, and I'll play you one last little snippet here. In 1917, Edison put out two tributes. Edison was known for putting out odd records that people didn't buy. put out two tributes by Edward Meeker and the Empire Vaudeville Company. And these were skits based around two of Johnson's most famous songs, the Laughing and the Whistling Songs. In the Laughing Song, Meeker and the boys are trying to put a minstrel show together. And Steve Porter, part one of the troupe, pipes up, "I can't find anybody to sing Johnson's Laughing Song." To which Billy Murray replies, "We've got to have it. It won't be a regular minstrel show without that song."
I've got a disappointment for you.
You have?
Well, what do you mean?
What is it?
Why, I can't find anybody to sing Johnson's Laughing Song.
Oh, see, you don't mean it.
Well, what do you think of that?
Oh, that's too bad.
Yes, sir, that's right.
But we've got to have it. Why, it won't be a regular minstrel show without that song.
Well, I'm just as disappointed as you are. I've asked everybody I know.
Have you asked Meeker?
Why, no. Does he know it?
Sure he does. I've heard him sing it.
And he's up in the billiard room now.
Fine. Give me the telephone and I'll see if I can get him right down here.
Here you are.
Hello? Hello? Give me the billiard room. Hello? Oh, is that you, Meek? Say, Meek, listen. Can you sing Johnson's Laughing Song?
What did he say?
You can. Can you come right down? We're having a rehearsal.
Is he coming?
Sure, he's on his way. Give him a send-off when he comes in. Here he is.
Hooray! Thanks, fellows. I accept the nomination.
Great! Hey, Meek, now for the Laughing Song.
Does the orchestra know it?
Do we know it?
Well, there were fond remembrances of him, but as I pointed out earlier, his memory faded memory of him faded very, very quickly. Very few reissues of his recordings, even in the LP or the CD era. And the songs he sang are part of that. They're songs we would wince at today in a social context. They are part of history, however. And I think even if we look past the material, the fact that he was the first African-American to record commercially, that he was very successful at it, which we tend to forget today, set a stage where it became possible for record companies and more easy for them to consider recording others. Such as Burt Williams, who started at the end of the 1890s, and such as Jim Urich some years later, and others. It was a very white and very segregated society at that time, and here was a black man who not only sold, but didn't cause anybody to burn down the Columbia building either. In fact, his recordings were quite popular. He was made to sing material that was degrading. Gradually, he didn't live long enough to tone it down, but others who followed him did, including Burt Williams, who started out singing the same kind of material, and as he got more popular, changed the tenor of it considerably, which is another subject I'll get into at some day. He made a lot of friends in his day, too, white and black, and I think for that reason alone and the part he played in opening the door just a crack at the very beginning to African Americans in recording, he deserves to be remembered and remembered accurately. Thank you.